So I have to say, I really remembered hating Spirit Folk, thinking it was a terrible episode, and I'm not sure why on this watch this happened, but I actually really kind of liked this episode a lot, and I think it's very interesting.
Well, they do something interesting with it. It's true. This is an interesting take on the holograms are real people thing that Star Trek has been dealing with since, hell, the cage. This is certainly be an interest of the franchises in Next Generation. This is where Moriarty comes from and all of that. And it's another development that I like. I just don't like Fairhaven. But I'm not sure how much the episode cares about us liking Fairhaven or not. I'm not sure. In other words, is this an interesting theme taken out of a kind of shitty scenario? Or are they expecting us to say, yeah, Fairhaven, that's cool. Ooh, and they know what's going on now. I don't know.
Well, I'm pretty sure that this is the last appearance of Fairhaven. I could be misremembering that, but I'm almost positive that it is. And if it's not, this is the last Fairhaven-centric episode.
Yeah.
This is kind of the odd point in Voyager where they actually have a little bit of continuity and follow up on things, because I feel like Fairhaven kind of needed a follow up, only that we had this strange thing with Fairhaven, which was primarily about Janeway manipulating the character of Michael and the doctor and her having this sort of little bit of a discussion about it. And it was sort of a holographic rights episode. So to follow up with it with an episode like this, I think is actually kind of astute, and it could have gone a lot worse than it actually is. I hear your point about not liking Fairhaven. I don't necessarily like it either. But this is less an episode where the characters are bumming around a fake 19th century. Well, I guess it's supposed to be early 20th century Irish village, because Paris is tooling around in a car. But it's less about that and more about what these characters are actually dealing with once they figure out that Voyager is real. And in that sense, I think it's interesting because it makes this shift about 30 minutes in where it becomes a first contact episode. And I think it's done very well.
Yeah. I mean, there is a degree of Janeway reaping what she's sowing. In other words, she gave Michael an excellent education and an inquisitive nature. And he uses that to kind of figure out a bunch of what's going on. I mean, the initial incarnation of the character may not have quite figured out as much, might not have been as able to bluff his way through certain of the encounters that he has to. And again, now that she's given him that, and now that he's figured this out, he does in a way have a right to know that. I mean, we have the Starfleet characters are people who are increasingly curious about their own world and who wish to know the true nature of things, and they wouldn't deny themselves the right to that knowledge. And so they are, you know, it does make sense that they would come to the point that, well, we have to give that knowledge. We have to accept that they want to learn the truth of their situation.
Yeah. And I mean, we have to get to the crux of the matter, of course, which is this is going to be an episode of Trek About where we once again talk about whether or not holograms are real people, because I agree with all of that. And I think that that is the real heart of the episode, the real meat of the episode. But that does raise a lot of troubling questions surrounding their use of this technology and surrounding the way in which they use it, shutting it down willy-nilly, having the ability to alter the program, to alter the very nature of these people. And I use that word very deliberately because I think the episode is making a strong argument that these are people. And I'm not really sure what to do with that information, because I'm not really sure if Voyager is able or willing or interested in grappling with that question.
In some ways, Voyager is trying to go a lot deeper into that theme of what constitutes personhood than Next Generation did, right? Next Generation was kind of the first steps along the path, and Voyager, by simple dint of the fact that it has a couple of series of themes to draw from in order to start its points, is going a little deeper, but I think Next Generation hit its ambitions a little more than Voyager did. Again, possibly by the simple fact that Voyager is trying to bite off a lot more, and this, you know, they still have the basic same format of television show.
I think that
Voyager and Next Generation posit, if not explicitly, I think that Voyager and Next Generation both do posit, if not explicitly, a kind of line at which point true consciousness happens. In other words, you and I are playing a video game. We don't really feel bad about the lives of the characters in the video game because we know they're just code. It's just somebody wrote a couple of these lines. And even in stuff with artificial intelligence doing enemy tactics and things like that, we don't believe that they are conscious, right? And I think that's the correct thing. But I think
maybe you don't.
Well, either way, we can certainly posit a line. I think we can say that a Goomba from the original 1983 Super Mario Brothers is not a conscious entity. At some point, I think we will be able to look at an artificial intelligence and say this is a conscious entity, whether or not we've invented that or not. And I think Star Trek tends to believe that the vast majority of its artificial intelligences are on the near side of that line, but there are unambiguous things that are on the far side of the line, and Fairhaven is crossing that line.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's a lot to unpack there, but the first point I'll make in response to that is that TNG was a much more philosophical show than Voyager is. And I have made this point over and over again, but Voyager is much more interested in action and much more interested in adventure and a sort of pulp sensibility than TNG is. And so, yeah, looking at the Moriarty episode specifically, I think the follow-up Ship in a Bottle, which is much more relevant to Spirit Folk than the first one, Elementary Dear Data, is that TNG was establishing the idea, right, that a hologram could be a sort of like conscious, or to use Star Trek's term, sentient entity. And so, yes, they were much more interested in having discussions about what that all meant. Voyager is living in a world where Moriarty exists. Voyager is living in a world where the Doctor exists. Voyager is living in a world where Vic Fontaine exists, even though they don't know about the existence of Vic Fontaine. So,
yeah.
I don't know if it's a criticism of Voyager not to say that they're not interested in interrogating that idea, because they already sort of have that floating around in the air. You know, it's kind of like, I mean, this is going to be a terrible analogy, but or not exactly a fitting one, but it's kind of like, you know, anti-abolitionists in 1750 or something like that. They were certainly there, they were around, but they weren't anywhere near as mainstream or strong a position as they were 100 years later, right? And now certainly I think that's a lot of people thought slavery was morally reprehensible and morally wrong in 1750, but they weren't the majority viewpoint, and it was still kind of a relatively new idea. I don't know when. I mean, for example, like I know that slavery was outlawed in the United Kingdom, I believe, in sort of like the 1800s, like early 1800s. So just to kind of put that in some sort of context. Whereas Voyager
I would say I think there's more people who kind of don't care or are thinking it's happening elsewhere. I mean, you and I can talk about conflict. You know, you and I can think that conflict diamonds are reprehensible. What are we doing to stop the diamond industry? Have we thought about the diamond industry in the past week?
Actually, yes, I have, but only because I've been listening to Lord a lot, and she has a song where she talks about diamonds.
But yeah, like I would think that would be a more common attitude anyway.
Yeah, for sure. But then I think, you know, moving aside from that, I think that interrogating Spirit Folk itself and looking at the ways in which Voyager is very much making a conscious decision to not deal with the ramifications of the decisions that the crew is making. And what I mean by that is Voyager so often will throw up its hands and present a situation and nobody will take any sort of viewpoint against her for it. And they will not even interrogate or question what they're doing or why they're doing it. And I guess that's okay. That's the show that Voyager is, and we just have to deal with that. But in an episode like Spirit Folk, where we essentially have a baseline situation where there is an entire town of holographic people that are aware. I mean, they're not aware that they're holograms, right? They still think that they are Irish people living in the early 20th century, which is kind of strange, but they know and they're able to understand in some sort of fashion that Harry and Tom and Neelix and Janeway are not, they're people that live in space.
I think the closest to that they're coming to it is thinking that they're from far in the future and they're visiting us into the past through time travel. I mean, H.G. Wells is mentioned. I think that's kind, that would be the metaphor that clicks in most people's heads, or at least they're far away.
Right. But like the very fact that they're even able to understand that much indicates that they understand something about the real quote unquote real world. And I don't know what to do with that, because once again, Voyager doesn't really have any opinions about that. It just wants to tell us an interesting story, but I find it troubling. And I get, like, this is a perfect example of an episode which I think would have needed a little bit more of a philosophical approach to it, because they are very much doing something which makes me a little uncomfortable, but no one is really interrogating the idea or even approaching that it could make anyone uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, it does very much obviously have to do with the position of these captains, not even beyond the fact that Picard is naturally more philosophical than Janeway is, and Janeway is a little more decisive than Picard may be. Picard's position is of a very seasoned captain who is at the head of the Starfleet flagship, and in a way, his decisions are setting a lot of precedence for Starfleet's attitude towards things. And so he does very naturally have to think of things with the weight of history and the full weight of the Federation's values, because when he does something, if he does something that is contrary to it, because of his position, that's saying a lot. Janeway, on the other hand, is still one captain in the middle of nowhere, and her main goal is to get her crew home. And while she is certainly striving to make better decisions than maybe she would have, and I think this episode has a lot of clear examples of that, she doesn't speak for the Federation in the way that Picard can speak for the Federation.
Yeah, I mean, I can certainly see that point, and I can certainly see, you know, to take that even a little bit further, to take the idea that Janeway is not a representative of the Federation in the same way that Picard was, is that she's not a representative of the Federation at all, really, at this point in this episode, and they are really dealing with a very unique situation. They are one ship alone in the Delta Quadrant, and so, you know, filling in the gaps, I think that you could make the argument that they're not dealing with the ramifications of this because they're in survival mode. They're not in the position to have these sorts of heady philosophical debates about whether or not it's right to turn off Fairhaven, it's right to fix the perceptual filters on the holographic characters, these kinds of things. They're really like, oh, we have a serious problem, we need to fix it. I don't really have a lot of time to spend on, you know, drafting a new rights, you know, a charter of holographic rights or anything like that. I mean, maybe that's something the Doctor could do. I don't know. And I think it's kind of interesting that the Doctor has very little to do in this episode, actually, which is maybe one of the small problems I have with it. But I also feel like this is the logical extension of where Star Trek in general has been going with the holodeck. I mean, the very idea just to like take this and really sort of examine it and sort of like turn it around, there's this idea introduced in this episode that there is a piece of code that runs in the holodeck characters called the perceptual filter.
That I do and think came as far as, I think in Next Gen they even mentioned that concept.
Did they? I don't remember. But
I know they have definitely addressed the fact that, you know, on the occasions that somebody has gone into the holodeck wearing a Starfleet uniform, or when they've mentioned a computer error, the other error, for the most part, the characters in the holodeck haven't paid attention to that, and it's implied or outright said that they've there is some kind of things that's translating it to things that they would understand.
Yeah, sure. But I think the idea in Voyager, I think this idea of the perceptual filter even takes it further than that, of course.
Yeah, it's more formalized.
It's more formalized, and also I think it's more troubling because, you know, you could argue, well, they program the holographic characters to just see the individual people or, you know, it doesn't really matter what they see because they're not real people. But now you have this idea that there is a piece of code that is essentially blinding them to reality.
Yeah.
And that's very troubling. What would happen if you took the perceptual filter off? Well, now we know they would realize that they were not, that weirder things were going on. And I don't know because humanity
has its own kind of perceptual filters, right? Like if you get right down to it, we are, you know, subatomic particles bouncing around, but we see the world before us. I can know intellectually that the chair I am sitting in is made of just more empty space than nothing, but it still feels like a chair to me. I mean, I wonder if it's almost kind of like that. I think
to some degree, I think that's true. But at the same time, the way in which we see the world is integral to the way in which we see the world. I mean, that sounds like psychology, but
it's not as though
that ability of ours to see the real world means that we don't realize when someone is pointing a gun at us or something like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's not something that was imposed on us, rather something that was evolved, you know, something along those lines maybe.
Right, because what would stop them from putting a perceptual filter on the doctor, for instance, and just like having him be happy to be in the sick bay all the time? You know, I mean, there's just weird things about that sort of trouble me. And I think what it really comes down to is it introduces the idea fundamentally that holographic characters, by dint of the fact that they have been created, are sentient, sapient, conscious beings that are deliberately handicapped by code not to be. And that strikes me as extremely problematic.
Yeah, I do feel like the series is trying to make the point, and maybe it should have done this more thoughtfully and explicitly, but again, that this isn't something that anybody really thought about until they had to think about it. Again, go back to video game characters. Even as AI improves, we're probably not going to think of them as real people until the one day that one actually starts talking to us and they realize, oh shit, like, I think that line that I've been talking about is fairly invisible in a way, and it can be crossed without realizing the exact moment. And I think that is part of what's happened here. I think the holodeck is an outgrowth of the way that we approach gaming and VR today, I would say. And I think that initially, we've got the holodeck to play games and to see beautiful vistas, and then we have some limited characters, and these are Federation people. They are going to improve and improve and improve until they've got into that problematic point. And as this episode is showing, now they're dealing with it. There is the thing mentioned a bunch of times is that... this is not how they were intended. I think there is in other words, holodeck programs are usually not run for this long, and so the characters never really develop that sentience because it's just not there long enough. And maybe that is their way of addressing that, but in other words, we're going to avoid the problem entirely by not allowing it to happen. But then are we going into a... I mean, is that along the lines of saying that if you abort a fetus, you're killing a person? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. And I think that a good, you know, a good follow up to that is the fact that that's essentially what happened with the doctor.
Yeah.
That, you know, he was designed for short term, you know, emergency use, and he just got left on a lot and developed consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's like you could make a very strong argument that they are violating the prime directive here, that they are interfering with the natural development of a life form.
Yeah. And that is a fair thing. But at the same time, if it is a life form that you created yourself, do you actually have a right to – does that maybe give you a right to not right, no. But then that brings up the question of if you created this life form, is it your responsibility to make sure they are shepherded into what as much as they can be, or – Is it the right thing to do to keep it handicapped? At this point, all holodecks have a perception filter on them. Is the right thing to do to keep it on or to take it off?
I don't know. I mean, is the right thing to do to keep my dog chained up in the backyard for 24 hours a day? I mean, like,
no. But when you're going for a walk, you're taking him on a leash because he doesn't have the intellectual capacity of understanding traffic in quite the way you do and all of that, and he's going to make sure he's on the right path. So, again, sometimes safeguards like that are a necessary thing. Certainly, if you decide that the right thing to do is to take off the perception filters, I think most people would agree that's something you need to do gradually and step by step. You don't just take it off and hope for the best. You have people training them in. And again, here is where we have the Voyager in the Delta Quadrant versus the Enterprise in the Alpha Quadrant, because we can assume at the end of Ship in a Bottle that they eventually dropped the Moriarty machine into at the Daystrom Institute or someplace that is able to put the proper processing power on it, where they have scientists who are going to make sure that the program doesn't degrade, all of those kind of things. If this is a gilded cage, this is the Federation, they are going to gild the fuck out of it. Explicitly at the end of Spirit Folk, they deal with the fact that we don't have the power to run this indefinitely because it's going to degrade. We don't have the capabilities of doing this properly. If you take the ferry, if they get home, they're going to take the Fairhaven program and give it to the same scientists at the Daystrom Institute who are going to put it in its proper spot, and then you will have a infinitely running world.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I mean, I don't necessarily have a problem with them turning it off and on. I mean,
no.
The implication has always been that it's sort of like a safe state, and then you start it up again and everyone's exactly in the same spot they were in, and they have no recollection of being turned off. Now, of course, that is a little bit different from what was portrayed in Chip in a Bottle, because as I remember, Moriarty sort of remembered being turned off. You know, the doctor has never really talked about, to my knowledge, what it is like to be turned off. So it's just kind of an absence of consciousness. It's sort of like a deep sleep state.
But the fact that the doctor can wake himself up and turn himself on implies maybe a very limited degree of consciousness even.
Yeah, I have no idea how that would even work. I mean, I guess it's kind of like waking yourself up from a dream or something. But I don't know. And I think that, you know, this entire conversation is making me realize that there really needs to be, you know, some sort of episode where they explicitly deal with a lot of these questions and come to some sort of conclusion about this, because, or they don't. I mean, there's only, you know, a season and a couple episodes left of 24th Century Star Trek, at least until the Picard series comes, you know, next year or whenever. So, you know, I don't know that they need to deal with this, because this is kind of a moot point in the world of Discovery, because holodecks don't exist at the time of Discovery. But I do think that they kind of need to deal with some of this, at least to some degree. And DS9 dealt with it, of course, with Vic Fontaine in sort of a different way. But this really is crying out for some sort of holographic declaration of rights or something like that. And it may end up with the Federation coming up with very strict rules about when and how the holodeck can be used.
Yeah. I mean, Vic Fontaine, they almost sidestep some of the harder questions by virtue of Fontaine himself being very sanguine about his knowledge, his own knowledge of his own existence. He totally gets that he's a holographic character. Well, that's okay. He's got his own bar. His friends visit from time to time. Whatever his life is, he's got his life pretty good. And he doesn't really angst about anything there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, I think that we would be remiss if we did not mention Tom Paris turning someone into a cow. I only mention this because this is the really like one sour note of the episode where I am starting to actively dislike Tom Paris.
Oh, yeah.
I like how you're just like, yeah, of course, that totally
makes sense. I mean, again, this is it's one thing if we don't have it's one thing if you go to your friend's porn collection and you splice in footage from The Exorcist as a joke for him, right? Like that's one thing if you do that, because again, we don't believe that it's sentient, but the Paris has enough of a relationship with the doctor that he should know better. And they treat him a bit as, oh, that scamp Tom Paris. And it's true that the woman is in no way harmed by the event. She doesn't really seem to be too terribly scarred from it. So, you know, he's already been demoted to ensign. What more are they going to do to him?
I have no idea. I guess B'Elanna could break up with him, and I think she probably should. Doesn't it? This is something I've been thinking about. Like, B'Elanna has been really sidelined the past season or so, and all of her scenes are basically her being a dick to everyone.
Yeah.
I don't know if Tom Paris is rubbing off on her or what, but they really seem like they're incredibly unhappy. And I wish that I really liked the character of B'Elanna in the early part of the series.
Yeah.
And now she just comes across as a little bit of an asshole. And I also don't like Tom Paris. So I don't know what the show is doing with these characters. And I think the cow thing is a perfect example. Of course, the cow thing is also the moment where you really feel the gears of the plot turning, because of course the two, you know, buffoonish Irish people in Fairhaven that are running around need to see something ridiculous in order for them to realize something very odd is going on. And okay, sure, let's have Tom Paris turn Harry Kim's date into a cow, but it just strikes me as like very, very sour.
It's hokey. It's spirit fingers, the episode, Matthew. It's not, you know. Again, the
spirit fingers? What?
Spirit figures, whatever it's called. That's the part of the episode that's the frame of the episode I don't like. And the turning into a cow is part of the frame of the episode. It's cheesy. It's, you know, oh, Irish land, ah. And the spirit folk, and they're going to get us. And I don't do a good Irish accent, but then again, neither does anybody on this show. The meat of the episode is more interesting, I would say. I do like that B'Elanna is kind of consistent in that she's always been of the, well, they're just holograms, they're just programmed, because she is an engineer and she really just does see the, I mean, she in a way isn't that different from the coroner who is eating a sandwich over the dead body and all of that and not taking the whole thing really seriously, because she is just so deep in the guts of it that it doesn't really matter. And yes, if she's dealing with, it doesn't really change her relationship with the doctor that much. She thinks he's made of code while she's made of cells, but she still finds him irritating.
Well, yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, not to belabor this point, but I think, you know, a better analogy would be a doctor who, you know, you have a lot of doctors, you know, you have a patient in front of you that is sick, that is scared, that doesn't feel good. And the doctor's like, well, all your numbers are good, so I don't know what to do for you. And I think it's that same kind of mindset where it boils down to numbers and diagnostics and these kinds of things. And you're not actually engaging with the person in front of you who is sick and scared.
Yeah, which makes, in a way, the doctor a little bit more of an interesting character, because he's very much not that when he's dealing with his patients. His patients are people who are very different biologically from him, but he is always concerned about their feelings, even if he is a little pompous about it. I also love that Neelix, apparently what he does is after a long day of running the cafeteria and cooking for all these people, he goes to Fairhaven, and at which point he owns an inn and is serving food for all these imaginary people. Like, it just reminds me of the time that I got really into playing Cook Serve Delicious a few months ago, and literally that's what I do for a living, so I could see
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Don't you enjoy cooking for, like, friends when they come over?
Yeah,
too?
I know.
You know.
Yeah, but at the same time, something. Like, I get home from cooking all day, and it's like, ah, fuck this. I'm ordering a pizza.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I mean, I have personal spreadsheets, so we just like what we like. I don't know.
Busman's all right, holiday well, is the term.
All right, well, let's move on to Ashes to Ashes. But before we do that, your weekly reminder that this podcast is listener supported. Yes, listeners like you support this podcast and make this podcast come to you each and every week. If you don't give to us right now, and do not, we ask you, please, to give us $1 a month. You can afford $1 a month. Maybe you can't. And if you can't, that's fine. But if you can, please go to patreon.com/truckaboutshow. All right. So we had a very good discussion about Spirit Folk. Good episode. Good discussion. Ashes to Ashes is fucking insulting.
Okay. That's interesting take. Let's talk about it.
I hate this episode so much because
it wasn't great, but yeah.
The actual episode itself is fine. It just presumes a level of complete disrespect for the audience's intelligence that, and maybe I should just expect this from Voyager, I don't know, but the entire conceit of this episode is that this character, Lindsay, died 3 years ago and then comes back, and Harry Kim has this like wonderful long-standing relationship with her and everyone is happy to see her and all this kind of fucking shit. We have never seen this character. We have never heard of this character before. It is insulting to my intelligence.
I actually can see this, and I can see you and raise you. Let's talk about Tasha Yar and her Romulan daughter. I think that was a perfect way of having a character who was killed off and who came back years later, and the circumstances are dark and fucked up, and everybody thinks that, you know, everybody's trying to think that it's their old friend. And, you know, that's because obviously there were circumstances around, you know, the actress leaving the show. But if Voyager had had a back cast, and if we had seen Lindsay in a few episodes, and if she had been killed, and if Harry Kim had had a relationship with her, it would be a much stronger episode in this way. Even if, let's say, she was a Delaney sister who was killed on an away mission. Imagine that.
Yeah, or just anybody. There have been other fucking Kess. I mean, like, I'm not trying to bury the lead here, because you'll see this on Netflix in a couple weeks. But and I told you that Kess comes back.
No, I knew that.
Yeah. Very soon. Like, I don't get what they're doing here. Like, it is just, you know, everything that people say about Voyager, and I think we try to be fair to Voyager. I mean, we just had a very good discussion about Spirit Folk, which is an episode that a lot of people revile. I will give Voyager credit where credit is due, but Ashes to Ashes just presumes a level of incompetence on the part of the audience, that the writers do not care about continuity, do not care about establishing this as a real world or a real place with real people in it, do not care that this character has never existed, and just create something out of whole cloth for her. Every time I watch this episode, I keep thinking, okay, there's going to be a twist. There's going to be a twist, and this is going to be like implanted memories or something like that. And it isn't. It's just, they don't care. They don't care. And that is what is so galling about it to me.
Yeah. They don't. I mean, the twist is that suddenly she decides, no, I really want to be a whatever. And she goes off like that. That's the closest it has to the twist. Again, I was waiting for this not to actually be the case. And I mean, the timeline, if you're thinking about it, actually makes no sense. So this is somebody that he supposedly knew from his academy days, right? Has known since he was a kid, maybe even. He was in love with her all that time. Right out of the academy, they got assigned to Voyager. He's still pining after her. they go on an away mission. He thinks, oh, this is my big chance, and she dies. And so for the past 3 years, he's still been pining after her. Number one, where does meeting Libby fall into this?
Yeah, true.
Because
the show is completely forgotten that Libby exists. So,
but that makes it even less sensical, though, that because we don't forget that Libby exists. I don't know. I guess that's but this is going to your initial point, is that it's insulting. It's not caring about what happened before. Even if we agree that Harry Kim and Libby have no chemistry whatsoever and don't really like each other, which we've only known based on that one projection episode that he had where he isn't actually meeting her.
Non sequitur, yeah.
Yeah, which I think is a little telling of what Harry Kim's view of his own fiance is, but I don't know.
And it's... Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. It's just like it doesn't – not only is it creating this new character out of whole cloth and creating relationships that frankly, because we should have seen before, that it also doesn't care about what happened before. And that is really what is so galling about it, which is just that, you know, time and time again, Voyager shows us that it absolutely does not care about continuity in any way, shape, or form. And I don't even know why that bothers me so much, because this is an episodic series. But I think it's just that – you know, there's a way to do standalone television that still honors continuity. TNG did it, right? I mean, like, TNG, you could sit down and watch any random episode of TNG pretty much and still get something out of it. The plot would make sense. It has a beginning, middle, and an end. But if you were a fan of the show, if you had watched all the previous episodes, there would be resonances there. You would get something out of it. A character here or there would mention something offhandedly that if you had never seen an episode before, it wouldn't matter. But if you had, it would have a new resonance to you. And this episode does none of that. I mean, it's just so aggravating. I find this episode just indicative of the problems of the ways in which Voyager handles its storytelling and handles the way in which it approaches episodes. Because each episode is an entire... This isn't even standalone. This is just like... This is like each episode is in like solitary confinement.
Yeah, because I'm thinking back... If Lindsay had really existed on this ship, Tom would be mentioning her every 5 minutes to Harry. You know, why are you in love with that holograph girl? Listen, why don't you and Lindsay go out? And Harry would be like, why would I be interested in Lindsay? Like, that would be a conversation at one point. Instead of trying to pimp the Delaney sisters out on him, Tom would be trying to get his friend and, you know, Lindsay to recognize that they like each other. Again, that alone would change their interaction. And frankly, this would have given Harry a character note. I know obviously they didn't think about Lindsay until the moment they wrote this episode, but that's just a symptom of their lack of caring. Again, it's partially the way that television is written nowadays that we are reacting to, where most television shows do have figured out their network of characters and would have come up with a Lindsay character. But again, the way that TNG grew a lot of that continuity out and frankly seeded a lot of stuff that could eventually be dealt with later on.
Because TNG had more respect for its audience than Voyager does. And I was about to jump down your throat until you talked about TNG, because I don't think that my complete antipathy for Ashes to Ashes is because of, you know, serialized television, right? I think that it has to do with a disrespect for me as a viewer. Like, TNG would not have done this. TNG would not have had an episode in the sixth season of the show where this dead character came back that had this relationship with Geordi LaForge, for instance, right? They would not have done this. And like, you could even have made this, I mean, of course, it would have even worked better on TNG because they could have pulled it off. You know, someone that Geordi LaForge knew in his academy days and thought was dead would come back, right? That would be easy to do.
Because that would have, because that could have been somebody who wasn't even on the series at all. Like, oh, she was assigned to a different ship and then she died. Like, this is somebody who should have been right there.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that's so aggravating about it is that she was on the fucking ship for like 3 or 4 years before she died. So we're talking about, she mentions the Hirogen at some point. The Hirogen didn't appear until almost the end of the fourth season of this show. So, like, we're just supposed to believe that Harry Kim had this like intense friendship with Lindsay and is also friends with Tom. And you're right. Like, Tom never mentioned her. He didn't mention her because she didn't fucking exist. And, yeah. And it's just, I know I sound like a crazy person talking about this, but I hate this. I hate it so much.
Well, you know, you talk about Geordi. I'm thinking about Aquiel, which didn't, which was kind of that episode. Somebody dead has reappeared, and that was the one, right? With
yeah, Aquiel, yeah, with the dog.
No, the one with his mother.
Oh. That was the seventh season. I forget the name of the episode, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was a case where, you know, obviously the fact that he has a mother is implied in the fact that he exists, but...
Right, yeah.
You know, that was able to, again, and we... But in that case, we had perfect reasons for why we'd never seen her, which is simply that she was living her life outside the Enterprise, and we've just never been in the same room as him having a phone call with her. And, you know, plenty of characters on the Enterprise had visitors that they had pasts with, and we hadn't heard mention till then. But again, by virtue of the fact that it's a ship in the middle of the Alpha Quadrant, everybody has dozens of people that they knew from the past, and they have access to them. Voyager does not.
Right, and to go back to your idea about Libby and all this sort of stuff, I think that... I'm just going to calm myself down a little bit by trying to fix the last 6 years of Voyager, because this episode is a microcosm of the problems with Voyager, or the problems that Voyager has. That Harry Kim, as we've said, basically doesn't have a character. They don't know what to do with him. And here's this character, Lindsay, that comes back from the dead after being dead for, I think it's supposed to be 2 years, 3 years. I forget how long she's supposed to have been dead. And Harry Kim knew her in her academy days. They both served on Voyager together. You know, she was lost in the Delta Quadrant with them. And what would have been an interesting character note for Harry Kim would have been, okay, he's got this girlfriend, fiance, Libby back on Earth, and they are now lost in the Delta Quadrant. He doesn't know what to do about this. Oh, and here is his good friend, Lindsay, who he has had feelings for ever since he was an 18-year-old Academy student. And can you just see the episodes, or can you see the scenes that are playing out in your head right now?
Yeah.
Like, he's talking to Tom Paris about it, and Tom Paris is telling him to go for it. And he's talking to Neelix about it late at night in the mess hall. And, you know, and it's just like, but none of that happened because this character did not exist before they wrote this episode. And it is so, like, it would have made the character of Harry Kim so much better. Like, it's not even that great of a character note, honestly, but it's better than what they gave him to do the last 6 years.
I mean, I'm imagining the scene in which Tom is talking to B'Elanna about this great scheme for a double date that he's going to, so that finally Harry Kim will ask Lindsay out, and B'Elanna's reaction to that. And as you said, that's more interesting than anything she's done in the past couple months.
Yeah, yeah. And I just think that, I mean, I don't know. I think I've said all I can say about it. I got my vitriol out. And now let's turn to the actual mechanics of the plot. Because aside from the very real problems that I talked about for 10 or 15 minutes, this episode is fine. Like, you know, absent all of the structural problems with the television series Star Trek Voyager that this episode lays bare, like, this is a fine episode. You know, Harry Kim gets something to do. I think that the actress who plays Lindsay is you know, a good actress. She does a great job. I enjoy the idea of these aliens, the Kobali, that reproduce by finding dead people, which I don't even know how that would work, but whatever.
Yeah, it's... But I guess part of my question is, what do we learn from this? Like, is, you know, as in Spirit Folk was a meditation on the existence of holograms and what consciousness is, and do we have the right to this? And it was interesting, but like, what are we getting from this? Is it just a simple, you need to let the dead go?
I guess so, yeah. I mean, that's what I would say the point of the episode is, and or you can't control things. I mean, that's kind of like the B plot with Seven and the children, that you can't control what people want to do or what they can't do. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think the A and the B plot work that well together, but if anything, I think that might be the theme that's trying to tie those two plots together.
Seven of Nine's plot was there.
Well, we'll deal with that in a minute, but and it feels good to be getting back to old school Trek about where we have an A and a B plot to examine.
Yeah, that's
but,
true.
Yeah, I think that the point is that you just have to let the dead go. And not even that, but you have to let the past go, because Harry Kim and Janeway and all of these people have let Lindsay go because she never existed. I can't get away from that point. But Lindsay also has to let the past go, that obviously people don't die and come back to life. I mean, that's not a thing that happens unless you believe in reincarnation. But it is the case that we accept the reality of the premise of this episode, that Lindsay Ballard died, that she was found by these aliens, they made her into a new person, and that she is no longer Lindsay, right? And so we have had so many points in our lives when the reality of our life has changed substantially, and you just need to let the past go and then look forward and move ahead. And I think that's what the point of the episode is. Is it a revelatory point? No, of course not. But what we have.
You're right. It's like meeting a friend from college, and you were super close then, but your life took you in very different directions, and you're not the same people. You don't have the same things in common, and it's not clicking anymore. You can still view those relationships warmly, and I guess that works for it.
Just trying to capture the past and all
No, that's. Again, I think if she had been a fan favorite character who had been killed off in a thing, that point would have been much stronger made, because then it would have those resonances of for the fans and stuff.
And I think I will defend this episode a little bit, or I will be able to say when it does good things, is that I think that is very nicely illustrated by the fact that they make her look human, even though physiologically she is still Kobali. That there is no changing what has happened to her, that she is still Kobali. She is not human anymore, but she wants to look human. And so it's an artificial construction of a reality. It's like, trying to go back to a different period in your life when you look different, dress different, had different friends, lived in a different place. It's that whole idea of you can't go home again, which, again, this is cliche, but this is what we have with this episode.
But wait, which is an interesting thing, considering that the theme of Voyager is about trying to get home.
That is true, too. Yeah, like, what does that mean for the larger theme or the larger point of the show?
I mean, we've certainly talked about the fact that, if it does take them 75 years, all of them, many of them will be dead. Anyone surviving will be old, unless they're a completely new generation that never even saw home. Like Naomi would be, Naomi's going to be in her 60s if it takes their original 75-year plan. Now we know they've only got another year, but, I moved out of my home for 2 years and I came back and everything had changed and I didn't belong there anymore. So it's,
right.
I wonder if that's going to play into the ending.
Well, we'll just have to see. I mean, I'm not going to say anything about the ending, although, I'm not going to say anything about the ending.
No.
Well, I think that's a good way for us to segue into talking about the Seven of Nine plot then, because I think it's very interesting that in an episode which highlights the very real problem that Voyager has had with establishing a bench of secondary characters, even though the structure of the series almost demands that it has secondary characters. I mean, we're talking about a small starship with like 130 people on it, and we just don't know who everyone else is, like interchangeable extras. Something that blew my mind actually was that I recently found out that there is an extra that had appeared in like 70 episodes of Voyager.
Oh.
But that just really tells you that they really had no interest in establishing any of these as real people.
Anyway. I mean, I'm thinking about, again, I think about Lost, which was only a couple of years later and which made a point to keep the same extras, and they seeded some characters. And when they had Paolo and Nikki, who were two characters that they added in, I think, season 3, and they did flashbacks trying to pretend they were on the island the whole time, the fans had a big backlash against it. But that's exactly what Voyager is doing.
Yeah, except that Voyager didn't even bother to try and do that.
Yeah. I mean, Voyager is just adding characters and saying they were on the ship the whole time. And
right.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I got. That's the thing. I mean, God, we keep talking about this. But, like, you could even have done that with Lindsay Ballard. Like, if I would have been fine if it had been this and she had not had this, like, serious friendship with Harry Kim. Anyway.
Yeah.
To talk about Seven of Nine a little bit, I do think that it's interesting that the series is establishing secondary characters at the same time that it is highlighting the fact that it has not done a good job with it in the past. And these Borg children, I mean, they're around. They're still here. We see them. Seven of Nine has been tasked with their education and all of these sorts of things. She is in charge of them. And this is something that the series is following up on from Collective. I don't think that the plot itself is all that interesting. It's a pretty rote examination of the difficulties of raising children and, you know, with a little bit of Borg stuff thrown in there.
I do think it highlights some of the challenges and the differences. In other words, at the end of the last episode, Seven and Nine was basically saying, well, I'll help these children. I've been through the same things they're going through. So I'll even have that advantage. Janeway didn't have that when she was dealing with me. And now she's realizing that Janeway did have the advantage of, we've always said, Seven of Nine may not have agreed with the tasks set in front of her, but she was game to at least try it and at least say, well, that did nothing. So, you know, but I've proven that it did not, you know, she was going to listen to what people were asking her to do, even if she didn't want to. And here are kids who are not doing that.
Right. Because it's almost in a certain sense, it's a little bit churlish to the character of Seven of Nine to ask her to deal with this because, yeah, Janeway took responsibility for Seven of Nine, who was one person and an adult at that. And now 3 years later, they are asking Seven of Nine to take, they're framing it as her graduation. They are framing it as, okay, you need to give back now. You've got all the tools that you need to do what I did with you, but she has four children to look after, which is a very different sort of environment than Janeway helping Seven of Nine.
Yeah. I mean, I do wonder if the initial intent was, you know, check up on the kids, visit them every day or two and, you know, talk to them. And if there's a big problem, you'll intercede. And Seven of Nine, being who she is, decides, all right, well, my entire day is going to be spent dealing with these kids. Like, it may be kind of, I almost wonder if that's her kind of doing a little more than was expected of her.
At the same time, though, I do think that that scene in Astrometrics between Seven and Chakotay, where she says, look, I want this to be taken away from me, and Chakotay says no, kind of belies that a little bit.
Well, yes and no, because at that point he does recognize that she's – it's not if she was saying, listen, I can't do these other duties. I think this is more important, mapping – you know, if she had made a case in that way, maybe he would have been more receptive. He's simply recognizing that she's finding this hard and she doesn't want to do it because she's resisting the lesson that she needs to learn in order to be a better teacher, and so – he's kind of forcing her to keep on it. That I took as the point of that scene.
Yeah, I certainly can
see
that.
She's giving up, not making a case for it.
Yeah, sure.
I'm looking for her and Neelix to form a little more of an alliance because, number one, they both have the welfare of Naomi Wildman fairly foremost in their minds, and you know, the two of them would be good to be teaching these kids. Neelix would do well with the Borg children, and Neelix would be the good fun teacher. And Seven of Nine would be the more, you know, intellectual teacher, and they would learn a little from each other kind of thing. So I'm waiting for that.
And I think there's a little bit of that in this episode. I mean, Neelix does talk briefly to Seven and sort of, you know, Naomi is kind of around the Borg children a little bit. And so, yeah, I think that they could make that a little bit more explicit, certainly, because Neelix did really take on and has really taken on a lot of the responsibility of helping to raise Naomi. I mean, I think everybody on the ship, frankly, raises her a little bit. That's kind of what's happening here. But that's natural and that's right. And I think that's a good thing. And then Seven, of course, also has a very strong relationship with her. So she does know how to deal with children. I think it's just that are Borg, it's a little bit different because she kind of like gets locked into a different perspective on them.
Well, she knows how to deal with Naomi specifically. Every child is different, to be fair. Mizako, whatever her name is, does seem to be... Yeah, they all seem to be challenges in different ways. She's rebellious. The older one is just kind of at that asshole stage. The twins are really kind of in their own world together, and they don't really care about what's going on. Like, these are all those are different challenges from each other and from what Naomi was.
And is it just me, or is there something kind of off-putting about those twins? Like, I can't...
There's something really... off-putting about twins.
Okay, fair enough. I'll just leave that there.
But not if we have twin listeners, because that's double the Patreon funds. So,
very true.
Well, I do appreciate that this episode does finally end with Harry finding a girlfriend, and the fact that she's eight is something that I am going to overlook, but I'm glad he's finally happy.
All right, you know, I thought the same thing at the end of this episode. I wasn't going to say anything because I didn't want to go there.
They walk hand in hand.
You did, and I applaud that. I applaud your commitment to a very strong and comprehensive analysis of every episode of Star Trek. Yeah, that's a little weird. I don't know how to feel about that, but anyway. Well, I should say one other thing, which is that the scene where Lindsay goes to Janeway's quarters to have dinner with her is delightful. I love the fact that Janeway apparently eats peanut butter and jelly sandwiches so often that she just has a stack of sliced bread on her table. Like, what is this? What?
I just don't know how you burn something in a replicator.
Yes, thank you. That was going to be my next point, which is,
but
I know it's funny, it's a joke, ha ha, Janeway's a bad cook, I guess. But yeah, how the hell do you, how does a replicator burn something? That doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense whatsoever.
I was ready for Lindsay to start eating the burnt pot roast because as a whatever, she has no taste buds and they only eat gray hummus. So I thought she was going to get that. And like, wow, this is the most delicious thing I've eaten since coming here.
That could have been interesting, but I think that would have belied the point of the scene a little bit, which is that was going to freak out about something. So, yeah. All right. Well, I think we'll call it an episode. If you have any thoughts that you would like to share with us on either of these episodes, please leave a comment on the post for this episode of the podcast at trekaboutshow.com. As I said earlier, and as Richard just mentioned, we do have a Patreon. That Patreon is a website where you can donate money to us each month in exchange for giving you podcasts. Please go to patreon.com/trekaboutshow and give now. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, we are on social media. Even though social media is terrible for you and you should quit it, Trek About Show is our username in all those places. And as always, please leave us an Apple Podcast review. It is the best way for new people to find the show. All right, we are rapidly reaching the end of the sixth season of Star Trek Voyager. One season to go until we meet the crew of the Enterprise again. This time it's the NX-01. We are getting very close to Enterprise, the last of Berman-era Star Trek. Get excited, but we still have a few episodes of Voyager to go. Next week, we're going to be talking about Child's Play and Good Shepherd.